Okay, well, I think we've got a quorum, so we're going to get started. Yeah, we're covering a very large subject today, so bear with me, and feel free to interrupt. It's a much more casual setting than anticipated, so take advantage of it. So I'll be talking today. I am Dr. Jim, renal attending. I think I know most of you. I will be talking about the two huge subjects of chronic kidney disease and dialysis. They seem to be similar as one leads to the other, but they have distinct differences. So chronic kidney disease. First, we start with the definition of chronic kidney disease. And the definition we go by is established by the National Kidney Foundation, NKF. And the Kidney Disease Outcomes Quality Initiative called DOKI. So when nephrologists talk about guidelines, they always go by the K-DOKI guidelines. And their criteria for chronic kidney disease is anybody with kidney damage for more than 3 months, with or without GFR, but as you know, most of our patients do have decreased GFR. And clinically, they are manifested either by pathologic abnormalities or markers of kidney damage, including anything wrong with the blood or urine, specifically creatinine or other markers of filtration problems or any problems in the imaging, oftentimes an ultrasound or a CAT scan. Or if a patient has a GFR of less than 60 ml per minute per 1.73 meters squared for more than 3 months. Now, beware that this GFR calculation is in terms of ml per minute, but it's per 1.73 meters squared, which is an average body surface area of a person. And in our population, I think most of our patients are actually larger than 1.73. So we're not sure where this number came from, but we have to bear in mind that this is specific for this, and if our GFR is 60 for a bigger person, they may already have met criteria for CKD with a higher GFR. What are the causes of ESRD? ESRD standing for end-stage renal disease. Of course, they usually start with CKD, leading towards ESRD. Well, this data is from the USRDS, or US Renal Data System, which is a national data system compiled back in 2006. Unfortunately, our most current report, which is already 2 years old. And it shows that diabetes comprises the highest percentage of cause of ESRD, 36.7%. But this probably does vary from region to region. Our population is probably more than 50% of end-stage renal disease caused by diabetes. Hypertension, a large percentage of 24.4%. And then it starts trickling down to glomerulonephritis, 16.1%. Cystic or congenital diseases, less than 10%. Interstitial nephritis, pyelonephritis, less than 5%. And secondary glomerulonephritides, such as SLE, vasculitis, all the things that you learn about in medical school that seems to be so important, actually only makes up 3.3% of ESRD patients. In order to assess the kidney function, we have to calculate a GFR. GFR standing for glomerular filtration rate. And the only way we can do it is to estimate the GFR. Now, we usually compare all our equations to the gold standard, which is inulin. As you recall, the best substance to represent true kidney function is a substance that is freely filtered, neither reabsorbed, nor secreted, nor metabolized, or anything else that happens to its molecular structure in the urine as it passes through the glomerular filter and the tubules. And inulin is our gold standard, but it requires, in order to measure inulin clearance, it requires a continuous IV infusion, frequent blood draws, and a bladder catheterization. So obviously we're not doing this to every one of our patients to get a GFR measurement. There are other substitutes such as iothalamates, DTPA, but these markers may be easier, but still not that practical. This is a formula that I think most of you may have memorized for the boards, and you still may need to memorize this for the boards. It's the Cockcroft-Gault formula, and it simplified our estimation of GFR by utilizing the patient's age, body weight, and serum creatinine, and the gender of the patient. So women tend to have a lower GFR than men. Unfortunately, this formula is no longer as popular because it has been shown to overestimate true GFR. So if you get a GFR of 80, that is overestimating the person's true GFR, and it's not as accurate as we had hoped for. Presently, the most popular formula we use is something called the MDRD formula, derived from a study of modification of diet and renal disease. Basically, the MDRD study was a prospective observational study to see if decreased protein intake will halt the progression of renal disease. And from that study, we derive the MDRD formula. And it is a very complicated formula with exponentials, but it takes into account several variables. It takes into account serum creatinine, gender, race. There's the abbreviated MDRD formula, the four-variable MDRD formula. There's a six-variable MDRD formula and the seven-variable one. Our system, our computer system, MICES, uses the abbreviated MDRD. Sometimes you see in a comprehensive panel that the GFR is already calculated for you. They are using the abbreviated MDRD formula. This seems to be much better to true GFR. We feel, as nephrologists, we feel that this may underestimate true GFR. It seems like, you know, even normal-looking people are coming in with GFRs of 60. So it's really unclear where the truth is, but we're using this a lot in clinical studies and in our everyday conversations with other colleagues. This is also like an older gold standard, a 24-hour urine collection for creatinine. And basically, this formula, UV over P, urine creatinine concentration times urine flow rate over plasma creatinine times 0.7 if you're a woman, can also calculate the GFR, but something we don't do because we shy away from 24-hour collections in general due to the cumbersome nature of this task and inaccuracy. KDOQI has also come up with staging of CKD. Now we categorize the CKD according to these stages. Stage 1 is GFR greater than 90 and evidence of kidney damage. There were estimated 5.6 million people with stage 1 CKD. This is back in 2005. Stage 2 ranges from 60 to 89, 5.7 million. Stage 3, the most number, 30 to 59, 7.4 million. And this is very interesting. By the time you get to stage 4, GFR between 50 and 29, you've dropped off to 300,000. So what happened to all those people? You know, did they all die? That's a possibility. There are theories. Maybe they all died of cardiovascular deaths before they even get to stage 4 CKD. Or these patients just never progress to stage 4. They stay at stage 3. So that's another possibility. But it's an interesting observation. Stage 5 CKD, when your GFR is less than 15, and this is dialysis territory, you have to talk to your patient about renal replacement therapy. And unfortunately, this number is increasing every day. The natural history of renal disease. So the initial insult to the kidney may be varied from diabetes, hypertension, lupus, post-strep glomerular nephritis. However, if the insult does not go away, the secondary factors that cause progression are very similar. Basically, what happens is when you insult the kidney is that you're killing off nephrons. Nephrons, as you recall, is the functioning unit of each kidney. And if you deplete your kidneys of nephrons, you have less workhorses. And then the remaining workhorses will have to work extra hard. They start hyperfiltering, a process called adaptive hyperfiltration. And this is good in the short run. It preserves your GFR. So your creatinine looks like it's the same. It's working extra hard to get rid of that creatinine. But in the long run, there are damages, in particular from long-standing intraglomerular hypertension, causes inflammatory markers to be upregulated, cytokines that cause fibrosis, and essentially scarring in the end. Patients who suffer from who has adaptive hyperfiltration at the beginning end up with some degree of glomerulosclerosis towards the end. So long-term damage results in, it's clinically manifested by proteinuria, basically something wrong with the glomerular filtration process, and progressive renal insufficiency. This decline, fortunately or unfortunately, is generally asymptomatic if done slowly. And that's why oftentimes when a patient presents with CKD, especially in the clinic setting or even in the emergency room, it is a shock to both the patient and the physician. Like, how did this happen? Because it is mostly asymptomatic. There's no exact correlation between the level of BUN and the symptoms, but we do know that the higher the BUN, the more at risk you are to develop anorexia, nausea, vomiting, fatigue, all of which are uremic symptoms, non-specific uremic symptoms. How do you manage these patients? Well, first and foremost, you want to identify reversible causes. So even though we have a CKD patient, there may be a component of an acute kidney injury, acute on chronic disease. And the most common ones, especially for hospitalized patients, are decreased renal perfusion from volume depletion. They're not eating, drinking, they're vomiting, or they have diarrhea. They're on too much of a diuretic. So you want to identify that and take away that cause of volume depletion. Maybe there are on nephrotoxic drugs. A very common one is an NSAID, over-the-counter, something you really have to ask specifically for the patient because they don't consider that as a drug. NSAIDs inhibit your prostaglandin production, which inhibits vasodilatation and causes renal failure. So anybody with CKD, avoid NSAIDs. Urinary obstruction, not uncommon, especially in our diabetic population with neurogenic bladders, or our elderly male population with enlarged prostates. So always ask about that. So once you've reversed all identifiable causes, you try to prevent and slow progression, and we'll talk about how to do that. You treat the complications, you're probably very familiar with that, and then it is our duty, both as primary physicians and nephrologists, to identify as early as possible those who need to go on renal replacement therapy. What are factors that affect progression of CKD? These are unfortunately non-modifiable factors, but I'll just point them out. Age, if the patient, the older the patient, the more at risk they are to develop CKD. Remember, age is a factor in any of our formulas that we use. Gender, men tend to do worse than women. That's just a fact of life, unfortunately, for them. There was a time when we thought estrogen was protective in kidney progression, and there were a bunch of studies done to show that. So that may or may not be true, but it's very suggestive. Race. Kidney disease, any sort, seem to fare worse in African Americans, and that's a big chunk of our population, as well as Hispanics, but far more in African Americans. And genetics. We know that diabetes tend to run in families, and so do other nephropathies, like IgA nephropathy run in families. So there's a genetic component. Unfortunately, nothing we can do about right now. A lot of research on genetics of certain renal diseases, but it's all at a research level at this point. The modifiable risk factors where we come in. Protein. So our goal is to aim for the lower the protein, the better. Our guideline is less than 500 milligrams per 24 hours. None of us really collect 24-hour urines anymore, so a ratio of protein to creatinine ratio is just as good, less than 0.5 of that ratio. Hypertension. Our guideline is that anybody with CKD or diabetes, you want the blood pressure to be less than 130 over 80. There's no data to support this, but this is a guideline. And as far as we're concerned, CKD patients, the lower the blood pressure, the better. And generally, we treat them with an ACE and ARB for renal protection. Glycemic control. It's becoming more interesting as these multi-center randomized control studies are coming out. Back in 1993, from the landmark DCCT trial, which we oftentimes swear by, they had shown that if you have intensive glycemic control, you decrease your microvascular complications like nephropathies by 50%. And we all jumped on their wagon, strict glycemic control. And now all these studies are coming out, like the VADT study, the large VA study, showing that tight glycemic control shows no difference in microvascular complications. Certainly you want to know why there's such a stark difference. It may have something to do with their level of disease to begin with versus the end. The DCCT study was only in the type 1 diabetic population, and actually the rate of progression was very low in that study. So now we don't know what to do. Of course, you want them to have adequate glycemic control in general, but we're not going to tell them you have to have an A1C of less than 6 because there's no real data.
Sorry? The advanced study, mm-hmm. instead of the recent study, it's actually on cardiovascular. So kidney study, the quarter study didn't work on the tip kidney, but there's an advanced study from Australia that showed the 7 years, I don't know how many years,
So you're talking about the ACCORD study, which the microvascular complications data have not been released yet. They're still analyzing the data.
The advanced study, so
I was referring to the VADT study, which unfortunately did not show. They looked at kidney outcomes and did not show any improvement. Now the advanced study is showing us something else. Even, right? Macrovascular complications seems to be no difference and seems to have a slight benefit in kidney complications. So basically we've got all results, you know, better, no difference, worse. Core study showed worse macrovascular complications. So we don't know what to do with diabetes. We just say, you know, go to your primary care doctor, let them deal with it. But, you know, no strict guidelines in terms of that. Dyslipidemia, also no good data. Except to say that we're probably going to treat their lipid levels like we treat diabetics. We want their LDLs to be less than 100. But there seems to be a paradoxical effect of lipids that I'll go into a little later. Obesity, linked to higher rate of progression, CKD. We want them to lose weight for so many other reasons. And hyperuricemia, another marker that seems to be linked to the development of hypertension. A lot of research in this area. Hypertensive seem to have an increased uric acid level. Patients with CKD seem to have an increased uric acid level. So we want to treat this if they happen to be hyperuricemic. Treatment of the complications. You see these complications in the inpatient, the outpatient, and I'll go through each of those complications. Volume overload. Our bodies are able to respond to a volume load until our GFR decreases to dialysis territory between 10 and 15 ml per minute per 1.73 meter squared. However, once a patient achieves even mild to moderate CKD, they seem to have a less ability to respond to a volume load. So you want to be a little bit more ginger in giving them a volume load if you think that they need it. And how do you treat it? Well, you always advise on salt restriction and a diuretic therapy as mainstay. It takes care of volume and hypertension. Hyperkalemia, a very annoying complication because you're running after the patient, you know, running after the lab, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, in order to understand hyperkalemia, you have to understand the principal cell of the kidney. Where is this principal cell located in the kidney? You remember? So it's in the distal nephron, which means the second half of the nephron, but it's not in the distal tubule. It's in the collecting tubule. Okay, these words get... easily confused, and this is our collecting tubule cell. This is a principal cell. Beneath it is an intercalated cell. So whenever you have a patient with hyperkalemia, something usually is up with the cell. Something is not working 100%. As you may recall, potassium excretion happens here, a passive diffusion from the cell. But in order for potassium to come out, a sodium ion needs to come in, an even exchange of sodium for potassium. If you don't have sodium here, you're going to retain all your potassium intracellularly. And when do you not have sodium here? if the patient is dry, their volume depleted, all the sodium is reabsorbed proximally. You have decreased sodium delivery, and they become hyperkalemic. Similarly, if the patient is oliguric, no longer putting out urine, nothing to go, you know, no sodium to present itself at the distal nephron, so you're retaining all the potassium. What hormone acts on this cell? Aldosterone. Very good, very good. So aldosterone is very important because it keeps these channels open. Sodium, potassium, you keep them all open. It also pumps up this sodium, potassium, ATPase. So whenever you have aldosterone deficiency, and what instances might you have aldosterone deficiency?
Addison's,
you know, certainly. Not very common, but something you have to think about. But more commonly, iatrogenic reasons. You know, you give a patient an ACE inhibitor, they're going to have aldosterone insufficiency, and therefore they're hyperkalemic. And also, in our diabetics, why? RTA. Our diabetics tend to be hypoaldo, hyporenin. They get type 4 RTA. And therefore, whenever you have hyperkalemia, if you go through those two reasons, you've, you know, probably got the answer 90% of the time. Then you think about other, less common reasons if those two don't give you the answers. If the patient's on a high potassium diet, usually with this, because most of us, we probably all take high potassium diets, we don't become hyperkalemic because we have a functioning, hopefully we all have functioning kidneys with good urine flow, and we have good aldosterone levels. But if they're on a high K diet and they have something wrong with this and they become hyperkalemic, if they have increased tissue breakdown, muscle enzyme leakage, you may have hyperkalemia, and this we talked about. How do you treat these patients? You always advise them on a low-potassium diet. And low-potassium foods is not just avoiding bananas, which everyone knows, but also plantains, which is a cousin of the banana. Any tubers like potatoes, cassavas, tomatoes all have a lot of potassium. Prunes, artichokes, melons, cantaloupes, honeydew all have a lot of potassium. And milk has a good amount of potassium. So try to introduce those other ideas into people's heads because even we are oftentimes surprised how much potassium is in certain foods. And also give diuretics. Diuretics have the combined function of lowering your blood pressure, volume control, and lowering your potassium. And if necessary, K-exalate. Now, K-exalate may be used as a chronic treatment in somebody who's persistently hyperkalemic. You just give them 5 grams per meal, a very small dose. That's like a teaspoon. It's very well tolerated. So if you really can't control somebody, 5 grams per meal is okay. So something to think about. Another complication is metabolic acidosis. Why is metabolic acidosis bad? More specifically, it's not good for cellular health, certainly, if you have too much acid. But you could read here or shout out any. Why is it so bad? We're so scared of metabolic acidosis. Why is it bad? Maybe it's not bad. No, I mean, yeah, you get secondary respiratory alkalosis, but that's okay. right, which means that you can't keep up, so that means you're not going to be able to blow off the acid, which means that you become acidotic. But why is that bad? So our body, when our pH is low, we want to maintain our pH to a normal level. And in order to do that, when we have an acid load to our body, we want to buffer it. And where does most of our buffer come from?
Red cells?
Red cells could, but that doesn't make up the majority. Bicarb. It comes in the form of bicarb from the bones as calcium carbonate. That's the major organ to buffer an acid load in the body. And we're talking about chronic metabolic acidosis. Over time, when the bone gives up bicarb, it's also giving up calcium and phosphorus. So it's leaching calcium from the bones. It's giving you brittle bones. So long term, it's really bad for bone disease. Also, it turns out that uramic acidosis causes skeletal muscle breakdown. This may have something to do with the intracellular health, as you had mentioned, that you need to have a good pH to just maintain the health of a cell. It creates skeletal muscle breakdown, it diminishes albumin synthesis, so patients become very malnourished. They have a loss of lean body mass and decreased albumin, and they're very tired. So for those reasons, you want to treat the metabolic acidosis. And again, the guideline is that you should keep this bicarb, serum bicarb, above 22 milliequivalents per liter. The truth is we're not very aggressive about that. The interventional studies out there are not great to show clear benefit of treating with alkali therapy. But certainly if somebody gets to about 16 or 17 chronically and lower, we do want to treat them. And we treat them with sodium bicarbonate, which comes in tablets, or sodium citrate, which is a liquid. Sodium citrate you want to avoid in patients with liver disease because the liver converts citrate into bicarbonate. And also you want to avoid in patients taking aluminum, any sort of aluminum medicine, like aluminum hydroxide, because sodium citrate increases your reabsorption of aluminum. So that's metabolic acidosis. Secondary hyperparathyroidism. So just going to quickly review how this occurs. You have a normal kidney, you have renal failure, you have a shrunken kidney with decreased nephron mass. You have decreased number of nephrons. And therefore, you're not able to excrete your acid, as we talked about, but you're also not able to excrete the phosphorus that accumulates in the body. Remember, the kidney is responsible for phosphorus excretion, so results in hyperphosphatemia. Hyperphosphatemia appears to directly stimulate PTH production at the mRNA level. This is a parathyroid cell, so it goes straight there and revs up PTH production. On the other hand, hyperparathyroidism can confound hypocalcemia by binding to calcium and precipitate. You get calcifications in these patients. So it exacerbates hypocalcemia. Hypercalcemia also binds to the calcium sensing receptor on the PTH cell and revs up, stimulates PTH production. So for these reasons, you have increasing PTH. On the other hand, vitamin D. Now, some of you may have been at the lecture by Dr. Friedman last Friday about vitamin D production, how there are two forms of vitamin D. There's an active form, 125 vitamin D, with two hydroxyl groups, and one hydroxyl group, 25 vitamin D. 25 vitamin D is made in the liver and then brought to the kidney to be converted to 125 vitamin D, dihydroxy vitamin D, but it requires an enzyme that is located in the proximal tubule cells of the kidney. So as you have nephron dropout, you're going to have less amount of this enzyme. This enzyme is 1-alpha hydroxylase. And therefore, you have less 125-dihydroxy vitamin D. Vitamin D deficiency also affects PTH production. There seems to be a vitamin D receptor on the PTH cell. And so a decreased amount will increase these levels. So three factors, high phosphorus, low calcium, low vitamin D, causes secondary hyperparathyroidism. And we'll talk about why secondary hyperparathyroidism is bad. So how do you treat that? We've identified three factors, so we want to treat those three factors. Phosphorus binders. I think most of you are familiar. We first advocate a low phosphorus diet because most of phosphorus comes in our diet, and it's hard to control just with medications. You want to advise less than 800 milligrams per day. Foods that have a lot of phosphorus, any dairy products, ice cream, milk, have a lot of phosphorus, chocolate. So keep those in mind. Anything that has preservatives, like instant coffees, pancake mixes, have a lot of phosphorus. There are a few types of phosphorus binders. There are the calcium-based phosphorus binders and the non-calcium-based phosphorus binders. These are cheaper, and these are good for those patients who also happen to be hypocalcemic, which may be the case in patients that you've identified early. They're hypocalcemic, which actually we didn't talk about. They're hypocalcemic because their vitamin D levels are low, and vitamin D helps to facilitate calcium reabsorption in the gut. So you'd want to give patients calcium-based binders if they happen to be hypocalcemic, but if they're not hypocalcemic, it's better to give them non-calcium binders to avoid calcification deposition in the tissues in the future. The non-reabsorbable agents, most of you are familiar with sevelamer or Renagel. A newer form of sevelamer called Renvela, this is supposed to give you less acidosis. Renagel can give you some degree of acidosis. Lanthanum or fosrenone is another non-calcium-based agent that we don't have on the formulary, but it is used in the outpatient setting. Aluminum binders, aluminum hydroxide, was a mainstay for decades. Very powerful, very effective. Unfortunately, it also caused dementia and a dynamic bone disease and osteomalacia, and therefore frowned upon. But in the acute setting, you could use it for a few weeks at a time. We tend to use it, especially in our ICU patients, when their phosphoruses are very high. This will do the trick.
Is there any difference for Renagel and fosrenone, those kind of binders?
Yeah, they're both what's known as non-absorbable binders. Their molecular composition is different, but their idea is that they will trap the phosphorus in your gut, and you just excrete it through the stool.
Was on both of them. Is that
reasonable? I'm sorry?
I had a patient
who was on both.
Yeah,
we do that. We phosphorus control, and I assume this is a dialysis patient, right?
Yeah.
Phosphorus control is very difficult to achieve in dialysis patients, and so you try all things. In order for phosphorus control, a patient may need to take up to 5 Renagels per meal. And these are, you know, not small tablets, and they feel very bloated. And so to help with control, we limit, you know, maybe 3 Renagels and 1 fosrenol. So we're just playing with what they can tolerate. Next, we want to supplement them with vitamin D, the active type, which is by prescription only, again, to decrease the PTH level. And there are 3 types, only 1 on formulary, calcitriol or rocaltrol, paracalcitol, another name is Zemplar, and doxycalciferol, hectorol. These 2 tend to have a less hypercalcemic effect. Calcitriol has will also raise your calcium. So in patients with already high calciums or calcifications, you really want to avoid. And finally, the newest